Production funding for Behind the Headlines is made possible in part by the WKNO Production Fund, the WKNO Endowment Fund, and by viewers like you. Thank you.
Amy Wyrick on crime, juvenile justice, and much more tonight on Behind the Headlines. I'm Eric Barnes with the Daily Memphian. Thanks for joining us. I am joined tonight by Shelby County District Attorney Amy Wyrick. Thanks for being here again.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Along with Bill Drees, reporter with the Daily Memphian. So we'll talk about all kinds of things going on with crime, an unfortunate conversation, but an important one. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about juvenile justice and the spike and an increase in violent juvenile crime and so on. But one of the things, and we've had lots of people on and talked about various criminal issues lately, and one that I've asked the same question, and I ask it just sort of bluntly with the highway shootings. Mm-hmm. What in the world is going on? And from your seat, you're seeing some of the people who've been caught or accused of these shootings over the last year. And I know you can't talk about a specific case. I'm not asking that. But what is driving this dynamic of what random or not random shootings on the highways around Memphis?
I'm not sure there's any one cause. One of the challenges we have with these cases is solving them. Once these individuals are identified and brought to justice, we have very tough laws on the books, and we also have a great working relationship with our U.S. Attorney's Office. And so any and all opportunities that we have to sentence these individuals to as much time as we can, we're going to do that. But I think the case of Layla Washington is a good example of how difficult these cases can be to solve, but how dedicated our law enforcement community is to solving them. People out there watching this show, people in the community know things, they've seen things. And so for many of these incidents, the three young kids that were gunned down in their homes over one weekend, people know something about those crimes. And it's important for individuals to call and to report what they know to Crime Stoppers, to the police department. You can do it anonymously, but every little bit of information helps. I know that the presence of police and the state troopers and more law enforcement has helped curb people's conduct, but it really starts with the community picking up the phone and reporting what they know.
One thing that a number of people, Floyd Bonner, the sheriff, mm-hmm. who was on recently, Mike Rawlings was on maybe a month or two ago, I think Jim Strickland, I don't want to say that for certain, but all of them have talked about the change in state law that extended gun rights to the car, that you have the right to have a gun in your home, and the state law changed some a year or two, three ago.
It changed in 2014.
In 2014.
Yes.
They all pointed to, in various ways, that being part of the problem. That also had the peripheral effect of a lot more guns on the street because guns are being stolen out of cars.
Exactly.
Talk about that law and as you see it, the yes. impact it's had on violent crime locally.
So what we call the Castle Doctrine, the ability that we have, the right that we have to own a gun in our home without a permit, without any special licensing, unless you're a convicted felon, right? Unless you're a prohibited person, you can have a gun in your home. Our legislature back in 2014 expanded that right to cars, to give law-abiding citizens the right to protect themselves when they are out and about in their car. What's happened, though, is the number of cars being broken into has increased because what individuals are looking for are guns. They're quickly going through cars. They are quickly accessing whatever pockets and compartments they can looking for guns. And so that means we've got more guns being stolen, more guns in cars, more guns out and about in the hands of those who want to do evil. People aren't stealing guns for any noble purpose. People yeah. are stealing guns to wreak havoc.
Bill.
This sounds kind of like whack-a-mole, where you have a solution to something and then the problem maybe transfers and pops up someplace else, like unintended consequences
sure.
on this. Should our legislation around this have a larger purpose? In other words, something beyond, we got a problem with this type of crime, let's increase the sentences here for it.
Well, and that is one thing that the Tennessee DA's conference, as well as your Memphis Shelby Crime Commission, is pushing for, is an increased sentence for theft of a gun. Mandatory minimum time if you're convicted of stealing a gun. You know, there's a lot of talk about penalizing and punishing the gun owners who are leaving their guns in their cars and not securing them properly. I get that from a philosophical standpoint, but I don't like approaches that criminalize victims' behavior, right? Because then what we're going to see is nobody's going to report that their gun has been stolen. Nobody's going to report that they've been the victim of this crime. To me, what we need to do is send a tougher message to those who are stealing guns and say to them, you're going to do 180 days, day for day, no probation, no funny math, 180 days behind bars if you're convicted of stealing a gun.
Mm-hmm. Are a lot of the people that you see stealing these guns, are they stealing them for their own use, or are they stealing them to sell them down the line?
All of the above. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're stealing them because they can't lawfully go purchase a gun, and they're stealing them to further engage in criminal conduct. It's the tool that they need for the trade that they're engaged in, whether that is robbing, carjacking, terrorizing people, victimizing people. They got to have a gun to get the job done. They can't legally buy it, and this is how they're going about getting them.
Right. We also saw last year, I believe it was, that there was a note that more juveniles were being arrested by the police. And you've got some very specific statistics on juvenile crime. This represented by these bar charts. And it shows that there are more juvenile delinquents being arrested, being charged with violent crimes.
Violent crimes, yes.
But overall, when you look at all juvenile offenses, there's this line that goes straight down.
Yes.
On it.
Yes, so less juveniles are being charged with criminal conduct in Shelby County. That's a good thing. That means less juveniles are engaged in criminal behavior in Shelby County. The disturbing part of this is that a higher percentage of the juveniles are engaged in violent crime. And when we say violent crime, we mean murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, especially aggravated kidnapping, those types of serious, life-changing crimes.
Mm-hmm. Was this what led to the increase in the transfers of juveniles for trial as adults?
Well, I'm not sure there really has been much of an increase. There's about 13% of the cases that are eligible for transfer that are transferred. It's a very low percentage of the cases that, if you look at the law, we could ask for transfer on. Mm-hmm. We seek transfer on the worst of the worst. That 16-year-old, that 17-year-old who's now been charged with murder, rape, robbery, those types of serious offenses, and that 16 or 17-year-old has been in and out of the juvenile system, in some cases since they were 7, 8, 9 years old. So those are the kind of tip of the iceberg cases that we in the DA's office file a motion for transfer on. It's up to the juvenile court judge to grant that motion. But when you're talking about a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old who has victimized people in this community for years and years and years, and now all of a sudden they've robbed 10 different people in a 5-day period, shooting one, leaving them in critical condition, stolen cars, evaded arrest. What else are we going to do with them? Our options when they turn 18 is we no longer have any supervisory authority over them. So the choice is to kind of turn a blind eye and hope that they make it, or to do our job as it relates to public safety and to do our job as it relates to victims and their rights and seek that transfer.
When talking about the overall crime rate among juveniles coming mm-hmm. down pretty dramatically, mm-hmm. is that the number of crimes committed, or is it also a different approach to nonviolent crimes?
All of that.
Okay, so let's talk about that dynamic yes. of, and we've talked about this before, Josh Spickler was on the show from Just City recently, Bill Gibbons, your predecessor, and mm-hmm. now with the Crime Commission, talked to all kinds of people about this notion of the nationally criminal justice reform moving away from penalizing or punishing kids or adults, but I want to focus on kids, for lesser offenses, delinquency, not robbery, but, you know, missing school, petty theft, those kinds of things. The theory being, if you get that 7 or 8 year old that you mentioned
right.
into the criminal justice system at a young age, it becomes an almost self-fulfilling prophecy that they're going to get, it's not going to help them. It's not going to put them on the right track. It's going to keep them on the wrong track. Where are you on that debate?
Right. So we've been doing all of that work here in Shelby County for a long time. Working with our Shelby County school systems is the program SHAPE, which is the schoolhouse alternative to, I forget what it all stands for, but it's taking those types of low-level offenses, getting in a fight at school, getting caught gambling, disorderly conduct, things like that that decades ago that juvenile might have ended up at juvenile court, that's now and has been for a long time handled elsewhere. We also have a very large and robust and successful youth court program, right? So you've got individuals in this community, many in our office, who volunteer their time to handle juvenile offenses through a youth court model where the juveniles are the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge, and they hand down the sentence for the juvenile offender. We have recently in our office put three seasoned prosecutors out in the precincts in Old Allen, in Tillman, and Mount Moriah. And in those three precincts, Judge Michael has put probation officers sitting side by side with law enforcement, with the prosecutor, so that, again, those low-level juvenile offenses, instead of having to go down to juvenile court and handle the matter, we're handling those in the community, with the community, and for the community. I certainly think when we're talking about juvenile crime and even adult crime, we have to focus on the individuals who are committing evil, committing violent crime in our community. Everybody else needs to be held accountable, but that looks different, and the way we go about doing that is different.
So let's broaden that out to the adults, the lesser offenses. Mm-hmm. Even Josh Spickler, who's been a critic of yours, I mean a vocal critic, gave you credit recently, I think when he was on the show, for reducing the focus on lesser offenses. And we've talked before, and Harold Collins, all these various people, that cycle of, you know, a suspended license,
right,
then driving with a suspended license, then a $300 fine, and a $400 fine, and an unpaid fine, and then somebody cops a plea and spends a night in jail to get rid of that, and now they're in the juvenile, now they're in the justice system.
Exactly.
They have some kind of prison experience or jail experience.
Exactly.
Have you tried to shift away, and in what ways have you tried to shift away from fining and jailing people in the sort of broken taillight, suspended license category of offenses?
Well, so driving on revoked is a great example of that. I've been in the DA's office since 1991, and driving on revoked cases have always been kind of the albatross around the neck.
Revoked license.
Yes,
driving on
revoked license.
Yeah.
And there are two reasons your license could be revoked. It could be that you owe money to somebody. You might be the greatest driver on the streets of Memphis, but you owe some agency money, either child support or a clerk's office for past crimes or traffic issues, right? The other reason your driver's license might be revoked is because you've been convicted of DUI, and as part of your punishment for DUI conviction, your driver's license is revoked for a year. The category of drivers whose licenses are revoked because they owe money is a huge burden, and what we were doing in the system for years and years and years was prosecuting those cases, and I put quotation marks around those because all we ever really wanted to have happen was for these individuals to just get their license. But if you owe $15,000 to the Tennessee Department of Safety, that's easier said than done. Our office did what we could do and took a new approach. And we implemented a policy in September of 2018 that said, if your license is revoked because you owe money, this office is no longer gonna prosecute those cases. You are still going to be charged with a crime by the police department. You still risk spending the night at 201 Poplar. But when it lands on one of our prosecutors' desks tomorrow morning, that case is going to be null pros without costs. We've eliminated...
Wait, so you said a legal term.
Dismissed. Gone.
Dismissed. Okay.
Wiped. Killed. Yes.
Okay.
Quashed.
The debt is not put away.
No.
But you still
don't have a license.
Yeah.
But my office is not going to do anything further to make the debt that you owe greater. Okay, so we are just getting out of the business of prosecuting those cases.
How would you give a sense of number-wise how many people that has
not
been prosecuted because of that change in policy?
We track it every month. We've eliminated close to 24% of the General Sessions docket.
Wow.
By implementation of that one policy alone.
And that frees up you to do what? What's the gain that you made as a part of that?
Right. So the gain that we made is it gives us more time to focus on the crimes that the community cares about.
Right, because most people don't. I'm sure there's somebody listening who says, well, dang it, they should go to jail.
Sure.
They didn't pay. I mean, that's a debate to have.
Sure.
But that is not the concern that people wake up worrying about or get sky cop cameras in their neighborhood for or,
right.
you know, all the things that we know about violent
right.
crime.
And if my office were blessed with unlimited resources, if we were blessed with the resources that we need to meet the work that we have that comes through the door, you know, I don't get to pick and choose the cases we prosecute. Every arrest that is made in Shelby County on a state crime comes through the doors of our office. And every case that we handle, we want one thing to happen. We want that offender to never come back to the system again. For the worst of the worst, for the violent offenders who have proven that all they want to do is victimize people in our community, the solution is to incarcerate them. But that's a very small percentage
yeah.
of the business that we do. For everybody else, we got to find a way to come up with a solution that keeps you from reoffending.
Yeah. 10 minutes left. Bill.
So with the suspended or revoked mm-hmm. licenses, at some point, should the Tennessee legislature consider just doing away with this or saying, look, this is not being prosecuted, so why do we have this provision on the books?
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember it's not being prosecuted in Shelby County,
right?
I'm one of 31 elected DAs across the state of Tennessee. And the issues and the challenges that we have in Shelby County vary greatly from the rest of the state. I had to do what I had to do within my office and within the jurisdiction that I'm honored to serve in a way that I thought was best for the public that I serve. We have a high poverty rate. We have insubstantial public transportation, not sufficient public transportation for individuals. And these cases were really just, I mean, we had victims of violent crime waiting to get have their preliminary hearing, waiting to have their day in court, being stuck behind hundreds of driving on revoked license cases. It just didn't make any sense. So I had to do what I had to do within Shelby County. What the long-term effect of that is going to be, I don't know, because I've heard from some legislators and others that there's concern that money, right, that
it's
they would have
stream.
Otherwise
yeah.
collected is no longer going to be there. I'm sorry, but I had to do what I had to do, and I had to do what I thought was best for not only my office and our limited resources, but also the public that we serve, to focus on those individuals that we're afraid of, and to not waste our time on those individuals that we're just mad at.
Mm-hmm. The Memphis City Council members, some of them are reading a new book by Thomas App,
yep.
who was here in 2011, I believe, working on some of the juvenile justice questions, and it's about what he terms urban violence.
I've read it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Your thoughts on it, because one of the big bottom lines on it is that he says, okay, there's poverty and there's crime, and those two do travel together to a certain extent, but the debate is, which do you go after first? And he's very firmly on the side of, you go after the crime first, and that will help with the poverty.
Yes. So I've read the book, and I of course know Thomas and met him when he was here working. We're doing a lot of that. What he's really talking about is focused deterrence, and, mm-hmm. and you guys have covered what we call Operation Comeback. We are doing focused deterrence here in Memphis and Shelby County, identifying small groups of crime drivers. The first class that we did, it was 10 men, and those 10 men along the course of their criminal lives had victimized close to 120 citizens in our community. So we've had two call-ins as they relate to adult offenders with long violent crime histories. We've also had two call-ins for domestic violence offenders. I agree with most of what he says in that book.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is the resources and the capacity to take what we are now doing on a very small level and doing it on a bigger level so that we can watch the homicide rate go down. Because that's really what we've got to get a handle on,
mm-hmm.
is our homicide rate in this community, whether it's homicides committed by juveniles or homicides committed by adults, is too large. And in the cities that have implemented the focused deterrence on a larger scale, they've seen that homicide rate decline.
He also talks about gangs in there and says gangs are a problem, but that there's too much inside baseball on gang culture when it should be the violence that gang members do.
Right, and really what works behind focused deterrence and the point that Mr. Apt is making in his book is we know who the crime drivers are. If you stopped any law enforcement officer right now, depending on where they were assigned in this community, which precinct, they could tell you who the top 20 crime drivers are in their ward and in their precinct. We know who they are. And so what works with the focused deterrence and what Mr. Apt is talking about is you bring them in. You call them into this meeting where they hear a message of the violence has to stop. And they hear the message not just from me and the police director and the sheriff and the U.S. attorney, mm-hmm. but they hear that message from the community. They hear that message from the Pastor Kirkwoods of our community. They hear that message from the Deborah Clubs and the others who work in the arena of domestic violence, of the community is telling you the violence has got to stop and the guns have got to be put down tonight. Mm-hmm. If you choose not to put the guns down, we're coming after you. But if you put the guns down, here's a whole host of people and agencies who want to help you. And the first class that we did was 10 individuals. Six of those men went an entire year without being rearrested. They'd never done that in their entire lives.
Mm-hmm. And the first one that I was aware of, and this was kind of way back there, was in the Springdale.
So that was DMI. Area. That was the Drug Market Initiative. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that was
right.
Many years ago.
And these folks were invited to and mm-hmm. came before the church congregation, and the congregation, the community members, really let them have it.
Yep.
Let them know that they didn't like the way that their lives were affected by what these people were doing.
Right.
So it has, I would imagine that's shocking to someone, but long lasting, you come in with the programs behind it.
Exactly. We bring to the table, the way we've done it here with the two classes that we've implemented is they hear from the law enforcement group first, and then we leave the room. We physically leave the room and we leave the building and we turn the program over to the community. Pastor Kirkwood was the first speaker that we had at the inaugural event. And then we have a panel of service providers, Ron Wade with HopeWorks, DeAndre Brown with Lifeline to Success, all of those agencies that are out there waiting for people to come through the door and say, I need help. I need help with job training. I need help with a high set diploma. I need help with mental health issues, drug and alcohol abuse. All of these things. I need housing help. These individuals have a host of obstacles, and we want to help eliminate any and all those obstacles that we can that are keeping them from that right path. It's better for them, it's better for their families, and it's better for those neighborhoods where they live.
4 minutes left here. I want to shift a little bit. I remember years ago when the body cameras were finally approved and being implemented, mm-hmm. I remember literally the moment where you sort of blew my mind about body cameras and your office saying, I think, and I'm going to paraphrase you poorly, that you were fine with body cams, you're in favor of them, but the amount of work was not really being talked about.
Right.
That you all would have to have ways to process all that video, store all that video, analyze all that video, everything from a police officer pulling somebody over for a speeding offense to going in on a serve a warrant. I mean, just it was mind blowing. Where does that? What are we now? 3 years into body cameras? 4 years
yep.
or so?
Yeah.
How has that changed the functioning of your office? And has it been the burden you feared it would be, and that it has been for other DA offices around the country? I wouldn't say feared, but worried that it would be a burden that was.
Yes, our concerns were not exaggerated. Fortunately, the county commission answered my request and gave us funding to hire additional people. We have a unit in our office now that is the digital evidence analyst, and every day they're at work right now, and they are gathering all of the footage that is connected to every arrest that was made yesterday. And they're making sure we get it all, and they're making sure that it is connected with the case so that the prosecutor who's handling that case has it, and so that prosecutor can turn it over to the defense attorney. Because just like a defendant's statement, just like a photo spread lineup, or just like a murder weapon, this body camera footage is evidence.
But are they looking at every minute of footage that's been recorded, or just those attached to an arrest?
Just those attached to the arrest,
okay.
Yes. But the prosecutor, so it's really like a prosecutor is there.
Yeah.
For every arrest, because then the prosecutor has to sit there and watch it all and make sure that there's nothing in that footage that by law we are prohibited from releasing. I can't release your social security number to somebody. So if you've spewed your social security number to an officer, we've got to go in and redact that before we can turn it over. It's very time consuming. We've been blessed with the resources, and I talked about focused deterrence and additional resources needed for that. I'll be going before the county commission in a few days asking for more staff and more people so that we can grow focused deterrence in a meaningful way, and hopefully they'll respond positively like they did with the body camera.
So, I'm sorry for interrupting. No, just a minute left here. Staying with cameras, the Sky Cop cameras and the neighborhood cameras, which are kind of exploding the number of those, a lot of neighborhood groups wanting them and city council people wanting them. How does that impact your work? Are they helpful?
Yes, they help solve crimes. And the body cameras do as well, but the body cameras also help exonerate people. Just all technology, any piece of evidence is going to help us either prove somebody's guilt or establish somebody's innocence, and that's our job every day.
How much does, again, just we could do a whole show on this, the consent decree that limits some of the surveillance that the MPD can do, how much does that, from your point of view, handcuff them or not at all?
I haven't noticed any difference. Okay. So that may be a question better directed to MPD.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Sorry.
Yes.
We could have done a whole show on those last couple of things, but I want to at least touch on those. Thanks for being here. We'll have you back.
Of course.
Thank you for joining us. Know that you can get past videos of the show on the WKNO website, as well as the podcast of the show on the Daily Memphian site, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next week.
I mean, all of this event.